This is the second day of this November 2017 seven-day session. We'll return to our text from yesterday, the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, Wei Nung, and this translation and commentary is by Red Pine. We left off yesterday where the fifth patriarch had thrown down a challenge for his disciples to come up with a gatha, a verse, that would express their understanding and to write it on the wall. And the monks deferred to their precept instructor, Shen Shu. We ended up with them saying, why should we write a verse? So they all stopped worrying about it, and no one dared to submit a poem. And now, at that time, in front of the Patriarch's Hall, there was a three-section long corridor. Because people left offerings at the foot of the wall, the abbot wanted to cover it with scenes from the Lankavatara Sutra and paintings of the five patriarchs transmitting the robe and the Dharma as a record to be passed down to future generations. The painter Lu Chen had inspected the wall and was going to begin work the following day. Just to go back over this, three-section long corridor, Red Pine says that a section would have been 10 feet at that time, so it's a 30-foot long corridor. Or it says here people left offerings at the foot of the wall. Lay people would not have been allowed into the monastery, that is, past the wall. And this particular section was the one that led into the abbot's quarters, and the offerings that they would left they'd have to do it there instead of going in and presenting it to the abbot. It was a form of respect. In this part where transmitting the robe and the Dharma, the robe and the bowl sometimes, the translator, Red Pine, offers us this little bit of information. This is from a master, Yuan, who asked, did they transmit the robe in India? Of course, Buddhism originated in India and then migrated to Tibet and China, and from there to Korea and Japan and Southeast Asia. But this Master Yuan asked, did they transmit the robe in India? And Shen Hui replied, no, they did not. This is just a dialogue by two other guys who we haven't mentioned so far. No, they did not transmit the robe in India. Master Yuan then asked, and why didn't they transmit the robe? And the responder said, in India there were many accomplished people whose minds were not arrogant or deceitful, so the masters only transmitted the understanding of the mind. In China, there are so many fools looking for fame and fortune, it's hard to tell those who are right from those who are wrong. So it is that we transmit the robe as a sign of our school's authority. So that's our tradition. That's the system since Buddhism migrated from out of India. But in India, there was no such thing. In India, this revered mind-to-mind transmission that is so central to Zen didn't exist. It was more of a, if not democratic, it was a more egalitarian system. It wasn't a centralized system where you had this lineage in India. The lineage that we chant in our ancestral line, that was cobbled together by the Chinese. They didn't have that in India. All these ancestors, starting with Bodhidharma, and they didn't have it in a line as a lineage. These people seemingly all existed and were great masters, but didn't have this lineage. It's the Chinese who, for their purposes, because to the Chinese, ancestry was so exceedingly important in terms of authority, that they created that in India and then maintained it through China and then on into Japan and Korea. The point, of course, in the East Asian countries was to have some kind of a verification, so it isn't just a free-for-all that people announcing that they're teachers and causing all kinds of mischief, which is, seems to be what we're devolving into in the United States. Not entirely, but it's become more that way. And there are dangers with either system. The danger without a lineage, a formal transmission, is that people can do all kinds of things without any authority. The danger with the transmission system is that it can too easily become flawed, where people can receive permission to teach who really haven't had any realization. That, I think, is the bigger problem now in the West is, yes, people will present their papers saying that they're authentic, they have authentic transmission, but in most cases, and I choose those words carefully, in most cases, there is no enlightenment behind it. So they're setting the sutra here is setting the stage. This painter was about to begin work the following day. And the sutra continues. The Venerable Shen Shu thought. Venerable is the Buddhist version of reverend. In this country, we would normally say, you know, the Reverend Al Sharpton or the Reverend so-and-so, Billy Graham. In Buddhism, it's the Venerable for an ordained person. And Shen Shu, now we're getting back to the head monk, the preceptor instructor. The Venerable Shen Shu thought, no one is going to submit a mind poem because I'm their precept instructor. But if I don't submit one, how can the patriarch, that is the fifth patriarch, tell if the understanding of my mind is deep or not? It would be right for me to show the patriarch a poem that reveals my understanding, as long as what I wanted was the Dharma. But it would be wrong as long as what I wanted was the patriarchship. I would be no better than a fool who thinks he can usurp the position of a sage. So he's aware that the sutra is showing us here that this is a man of some self-awareness who recognizes that the sincerity is all important, the motivation, and that if he were to want it just to claim the throne, this would be he'd be unworthy of it. And then he says, but if I don't submit a mind poem, I'll never receive the Dharma. as he considered this, he kept thinking, what a predicament. Well, the fact that he's tortured about this tells us a lot, that he's not really anything he would submit can't be of any transcendent value. He's kind of strategizing. He's in a bind. He feels obliged as the head monk, sort of, to all the other monks are turning to him and say, oh no, you first, go ahead. And he doesn't want to let him down. He has to, you know, he has a duty to uphold. Finally, at midnight, without letting anyone know, he went to write his poem on the middle of the south corridor wall in hopes of obtaining the robe and the Dharma. And here, too, we can just speculate about his motives for wanting to attain the robe and the Dharma. They're not necessarily any kind of impure ambition. Here, too, it may feel a sense of duty and obligation in order to preserve the tradition, to keep the transmission going and sustain, or as Mumon says in one of the koans in the Mumon Khan, in order to support the gate and sustain the house. We don't know. We know that what he wrote was done reluctantly. But again, here we are with the mind of the head monk. When the patriarch sees my gata and reads these words, he thought, if he comes to find me, the moment I see him, I will tell him I wrote it. But when he sees my verse, if he says it's not good enough, it will be because I'm deluded and the obstruction of my past karma is too great and I'm not ready to receive the Dharma. The master's mind is impossible to fathom. I may as well stop worrying about it. So this whole description in the sutra of what the monk is going through, the head monk is going through, it shows us this vacillating, fretting that he's going through is a pretty strong statement about how he really is not someone of realization. But he was he's willing to do his best. So it says the Venerable Shenshu held up a lantern and wrote his verse on the middle of the south corridor wall at midnight, and no one saw him. And this was the verse he wrote. The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a standing mirror. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. Just a little bit of cultural details that I found interesting. The translator says here, until fairly recent times, mirrors in China were made of bronze. Most were small enough to hold in the hand, and they were kept enclosed when not in use. This particular mirror, however, is large enough to be held upright by means of a stand or frame of some kind and kept on permanent display. In his poem, Shenshu uses the phrase Ming Qing, bright polished mirror. And then the translator says, apparently he's contrasting this with Lao Tzu's dark mirror. I think of this very famous saying in Zen, the great round mirror of wisdom is black as pitch. This is the condition that we are moving toward, and whenever we're doing Zazen, it's a condition of darkness. which just means emptiness. We said yesterday that the word prajna literally means before knowledge. That's the black mirror, the dark mirror. And here, this back to the verse, the body is a Bodhi tree. Bodhi tree was where the Buddha did his zazen and came to enlightenment. The mind is like the head monk is drawing from a little of our heritage there, the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. The mind is like a standing mirror. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. Dust basically means thoughts. To not let thoughts dim the brightness of this mind. This is, of course, the work we're doing here this week. There's another little take on, slightly different take on dust that the translator offers here. It's a standard Buddhist metaphor for sensation and for affliction arising from our attachment to sensation. So our attachment to feelings, to smells and tastes, to sights and sounds, and so forth. These attachments that lead to affliction, again, dim the mind. Let's look at this line, this verse, or especially the last part. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. So what he's offering, this well-meaning head monk, what he's offering is a recipe or a prescription for how to lead a reasonably upright life. It's what the Japanese call bonpu zen, which means it's kind of a safe, plodding, well-intentioned, ordinary, uneventful type of practice. Just staying in the game, just brushing up the mind, buffing it up each morning before going to work, so one is a little more energetic, a little more responsive. Things don't stick to you so much. What people say, what people do, the stress that you encounter at work doesn't stick to you as much. It's okay. It reminds me of the advertising of current fad with mindfulness, where they trot out these studies that show that it lowers your blood pressure and makes you more effective at work, which can then translate into some more earning power. Good, some more earning power. Who wouldn't want that? A little less stress, stability. Yeah. Always try to keep it clean. It sounds a little like a Boy Scout thing. Don't let it gather dust. Okay. It's the best he could offer. It's what he was not a realized person. And it's way better than nothing. It's way better than not practicing. Red Pine says, he ends up writing a piece of doggerel that would have been more at home among Hinayana ascetics than Mahayana practitioners. The sutra continues. After Shenshu wrote this gatha, he returned to his room unseen. You might have said he slunk off to his room unseen and lay down. At dawn, the fifth patriarch sent for the court artist, Lu Chen, to come to the south corridor to paint scenes from the Lankavatara Sutra. The fifth patriarch suddenly saw the verse on the wall. After he read it, he told the painter, "You've gone to so much trouble and come so far, we will pay you 30,000 cash, but we won't need any images now." The Diamond Sutra says, "All images are illusions. It would be better if we kept this verse for deluded people to recite. If they rely on it for their practice, they won't fall into the three unfortunate states of existence, and it will be a great help to anyone who cultivates the Dharma." The master then called his disciples together and burned incense before the verse. When everyone saw this, they were filled with admiration. See, these young monks would have known how to evaluate the poem. And then the master says, "Unless you all recite and understand this gatha, you won't see your nature. Anyone who relies on this for their practice won't regress." So it's he's acknowledging that to practice on a daily basis is good. You won't regress. He also said you won't fall into the three unfortunate states of existence. So you won't regress into the three lowest of the six realms of unaligned existence, the realm of hell, the realm of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits, and the realm of animals. So it's a lot better than nothing. It's okay as far as it goes, this verse. Kind of journeyman quality verse. Just a couple more cultural things here. That reference to 30,000 cash that pay the painter. It says here, at the beginning of the Tang Dynasty, round copper coins were introduced that remained in use until the end of the Qing Dynasty in the early 20th century. I bet a lot of you have seen these coins here and there at a flea market or something with a square hole in the middle. But they were strung together into larger denominations for ease in handling. Each coin was 1/10 of an ounce, and so 30,000 coins would have weighed 3,000 ounces, or nearly 200 pounds. When payments reached this level, they were usually converted into their equivalent value in bolts of silk, which was how taxes were also normally paid. And then it says the size of the payment apparently reflects the inflationary crisis of the 670s. Wei Nong's time. And then after the fifth patriarch pays some mild respect for this verse, which, by the way, we can assume he did to help the head monk save face. This is such a big thing in East Asia, saving face, not humiliating someone. Then he, encouraged the young monks to recite it, and then it ends by saying, as his disciples recited it, they all did so with respect and exclaimed how wonderful it was. And now, picking up again, later the fifth patriarch called the head monk to his room and asked, "Did you write the gatha? If you did, you're ready to receive my dharma." He may have been testing him. Shen Shu said, "I'm guilty. It's true. I was the one who wrote it. But I don't dare ask for the patriarchship, only for the master's consideration as to whether your disciple," he's referring to himself, "has acquired enough wisdom to understand what is truly important or not." So he's someone of some humility. By the way, he went on to become quite a distinguished master in his own right. And then the fifth patriarch said, "This gatha of yours shows your understanding has only reached the threshold and has not yet entered inside. If ordinary people use your gatha in their practice, they won't regress. But someone with such an understanding who seeks perfect enlightenment will never realize it. If he doesn't go beyond that understanding. If you want to enter the door, you have to see into your nature. Go back and think about this for a few days and write me another gatha. If you're able to enter the door and see into your nature, I will give you the robe and the dharma." And then Shen Shu left, but after several days, he still hadn't written anything. You have to sympathize with him, especially since he does seem to be sincere. He's working. And now the scene shifts. He's heading now to another stage of this sutra. A novice walked past the milling room chanting this gatha. Remember, we left Wei Nung pounding rice, milling rice with his millstone around his waist. So this novice was walking past the milling room, chanting it as he had been instructed. And then Wei Nung, this is the first hit, the sutra, this point is a first person account. "As soon as I heard it, I knew it was by someone who hadn't seen his nature or understood what was truly important. I asked the boy, 'What verse were you reciting just now?' The novice said, 'Don't you know? The abbot said, nothing is more important than life and death, and he wants to pass on his robe and his dharma. So he told his disciples to write a gatha and show it to him, and he'll give his robe and dharma to whoever understands what is truly important, and that person will become the sixth patriarch.'" One of the senior monks, Shen Shu, wrote this formless gatha along the south corridor. And the patriarch told all of his disciples to recite it, and whoever understands this gatha will see their nature, and whoever uses it for their practice will achieve liberation. And now back to Wei Nung. "I replied, 'I've been treading this mill more than 8 months, and I've never been to the front of the Patriarch's Hall. Could you please lead me to the south corridor so that I can see this gatha and pay my respects? I hope that by reciting it, I'll establish a karmic connection and be reborn in a Buddha land.'" Or be born where he could come to awakening. here too. Remember that the Wei Nong was first introduced to the Dharma when he overheard an itinerant monk reciting a line from reciting the Diamond Sutra at the door of the retailer where he had delivered wood, and how hearing it is so important rather than just reading it. There's a saying in Zen, hear the truth, practice it, realize it. Not read it, but hear it. And then I want to read what Red Pine says here. I think it's very, very good. He hears this verse that the head monk had written, and then Red Pine says, "Rare is the account of a Zen master enlightened while reading a book. Oral understanding is far more direct, far more basic than visual understanding. Beings in this world's primal sea developed ears long before they developed eyes. And written language hasn't been around for more than a few thousand years, while spoken language goes back hundreds of thousands of years, if not further. Civilization may be based on the visual comprehension of symbols, but the liberation of the mind is often hampered, even doomed, by dependence on such media." And then he says, "This book, too, hardly compares to hearing a teaching directly." For years I've thought about inviting Red Pine to come to the center and give a talk. Still trying to get around to doing that. So then the novice led me, this is first person, Wei Nong speaking. "The novice then led me to the south corridor where I bowed before the gata. Because I was illiterate, I asked someone to read it. Once I heard it, I understood what was truly important, and I also composed a gata of my own. I asked someone who could write to write it on the west corridor wall so that I could reveal my mind. Unless you know your own mind, studying the Dharma is useless. But once you know your mind and see into your nature, you understand what is truly important." There's another version of this sutra. It goes like this: "I asked an educated man to read it, for I hoped that by hearing it I would be reborn in a Buddha assembly." And then after Wei Nong heard it, he said, "I also have a gata which I hope the administrative aide will write for me." The aide said, "You also have a gata? Now that's really amazing." And then Wei Nong said, "Someone who wants to cultivate perfect enlightenment should not belittle someone who is just beginning. The lowest of the low might possess the highest wisdom, and the highest of the high might be in want of wisdom. When you belittle people, you incur boundless retribution." This is where it gets interesting. And the governor's aide said, "All right, just recite your gata and I'll write it for you. But if you obtain the Dharma, you have to liberate me first." And then he adds, "Don't forget." And then he gets this guy to write his own, that is, Wei Nung's verse. Bodhi doesn't have any trees. This mirror doesn't have a stand. Our Buddha nature is forever pure. Where do you get this dust? Then I composed another one. The mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror's stand. The mirror itself is so clean, dust has no place to land. Now this is a horse of another color. Let's just compare them again. The head monks, I'll just do the last two lines. The head monk, always try to keep it clean, don't let it gather dust. And then the six patriarchs, the mirror itself is so clean, dust has no place to land. This gets to the very essence of the Dharma, teaching of emptiness, shunyata, that everything ultimately is nothing, no thing. Nothing has any ultimate substantiality to it. This is someone who's seen into his true nature. And now the sutra continues. When the disciples in the courtyard saw these gatas of mine, they were all dumbfounded. After I left and went back to the milling room, the fifth patriarch suddenly came down the corridor and also saw them, that is, the two verses. He knew I understood what was truly important, but he didn't want others to know. So he told everyone, this one doesn't get it either. So here too, we see in this saga, this tale that's hundreds and hundreds of years old, the fifth patriarch, why would he do that? Why didn't he want others? Why would he say to the others, this one doesn't get it either? When we know by what's coming that he saw that Wei Nung had realized his true nature. Again, it's politics. So many people dismiss politics as just some kind of vile thing, that if only we could get rid of politics, then everything would be just grand. Well, we can't get rid of politics until we get rid of people, human nature. And one of the themes of this story is that this newcomer, this 21 or 23-year-old Wei Nung, appearing on the doorstep of this monastery, and the idea that the fifth patriarch would give the robe and the bowl to him would not have gone over well with the rest of the monks who'd been putting in their time there possibly for years and years and years. And like any good abbot, the fifth patriarch knew that he had to be skillful in how he did this and not just blurt out, okay, this guy is my successor. And now, in the dead of night, or as it says here, at the beginning of the third watch, there were 2-hour so-called watches through the night. They started at 7 o'clock in the evening, and this was the third watch, so between 11 and 1 in the morning, the fifth patriarch called me into his room and explain the Diamond Sutra to me. I think that must be a mistake. Explained it. He doesn't need it explained to him. As soon as I heard the words, I understood. Again, the oral, hearing it, not reading it. In another version, it gives this additional material. When the fifth patriarch goes and what we just read has this, the fifth patriarch summoning, sending someone to go and bring the Wei Nun to his room. But the version that I've heard more is the following. The following day, the fifth patriarch went unobserved to the milling room and saw me wearing my waist stone milling rice. No, my waist stone milling rice. He said, "Someone who seeks the way forgets about their body for the sake of the teaching. This would seem to be true of you. But tell me, is the rice ready or not?" There it is, loaded with significance. I answered, "The rice has been ready for a long time. It just needs to be winnowed." The patriarch then struck his staff on the ground 3 times. And left. This is the part that always gets me. This, Wei Nan says, "I understood the patriarch's meaning, and when the bell was struck 3 times at the end of the third watch, I entered his room." Who wouldn't know that that's what it meant? That was a joke. I wouldn't have known that's what it meant. And then this other version has when Wei Nung shows up in the quarters of the abbot. It says, "The abbot made a curtain of his robe so that no one would see, and he read the Diamond Sutra to me. When he reached this line, 'Arouse the mind without its abiding anywhere,' I suddenly realized that nothing in this world is separate from our own nature." And that, according to the story, was the turning words for Wei Nung that brought him to full realization. Whatever that experience was at the shopkeeper's place seems to have been just a tip-of-the-tongue taste of Kensho. This is where it opened, his mind opened wide. Okay, this is as good a time as any to stop for the day, this enlightenment of Wei Nung's, and we'll continue tomorrow. All beings without number, I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to present all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot
Dharma gives beyond measure, I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I vow to attain all beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions, I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure, I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I vow to attain.